Well, good evening, everyone. Back in Missouri, where I come from, on a day like this, if you met somebody, they'd always say, "Hot enough for you?" No, it's not hot enough yet. We're working on it, though.
Wait for Sashin,
yes. I remember my knees on a zabutan, and I'd get up after a sit, and there'd be two wet patches right where my knees had been. That's just the way it works. Let's do introductions around.
Judy.
Nico.
Bastian.
Leslie.
Marie.
Violet.
Dawn.
Ross.
Wendy.
Stefan.
Yeah.
Angie. So we've come to a place in the Genjo that's one of my favorites. It's about the ocean again. He keeps coming back to boats and water. Okamura thinks it's because he crossed the Great Water and went to China, which was indeed a very dangerous trip, and many ships didn't make it at all. It's not a friendly piece of water in the first place, so it's very hard to traverse, especially in the old days. So I think he got a lot of insight from just being on a boat in the water and thinking about it and feeling about it, what it was. I think if we've been in the water for very much, we do that. We begin to identify with being in the water and noticing what it's like to be moving in a different way. So he says, when the Dharma has not yet fully penetrated body and mind, one thinks one is already filled with it. This is a funny thing to say. When the Dharma has not yet fully penetrated the body and mind, one thinks one has already filled with it. When the Dharma fills body and mind, one thinks something is still lacking. Well, that's very important. It means that we can't walk around feeling, "I've got it. Now I've got it. Oh, now it feels really good, and this is it, and I don't have to do any more. I'm done. Let's go and do something else." It can become a kind of ambitious little trip that we give ourselves. And then we come to a certain point and we think, "Oh, this is it." And sometimes the "it" can be a quite remarkable experience, and people can get stuck there. So every Zen master is always encouraging us not to get stuck anywhere, because that's just a false place to be. It's just another thought, a thought we're stuck to. He says, for example, when we sail a boat into the ocean beyond sight of land, and our eyes scan the horizon in the four directions, it simply looks like a circle. No other shape appears. This great ocean, however, is neither round nor square. It has inexhaustible characteristics. To a fish, it looks like a palace. To a heavenly being, a jeweled necklace. To us, as far as our eyes can see, it looks like a circle. all the myriad things are like this. Within the dusty world and beyond, there are innumerable aspects and characteristics. We only see or grasp as far as the power of our eye of study and practice can see. When we listen to the reality of myriad things, we must know that there are inexhaustible characteristics in both ocean and mountains, and there are many other worlds in the four directions. This is true not only in the external world, but also right under our feet or within a single drop of water. So he knew long before we had microscopes, he knew even in a drop of water that there were many, many beings stirring around and having a life. Having little dramas and coming and going, being born and dying, just like we. Seeing the ocean as a circle is our ignorance. It just looks like that, unless we. When I was a child, my father invented a box. He built a box with glass at the bottom, and he made it soft around the top, and you could put your head in and stick it into the water as from the little rowboats that we had, and you could see everything that was happening inside the water, which you can't see otherwise. And there was a whole other world in there. It was so beautiful and so fascinating. Fish going, and little weeds and things going with the water. It was just beautiful. So he saw that, Dogen saw that. He felt it. And if we think about our life and think about the life all around us, it is so incredibly complex and inexhaustible, as he says. You could just take 1 inch of a tree and live the rest of your life knowing more and more about it. There are so many things to know. We'll never know all of it. And that's part of the message of this. That's part of what he's saying. So he said, as you may recall, this is Okamura. Dogen says in section 7 that when we first seek the Dharma, we stray far from the boundary of the Dharma. And when the Dharma is correctly transmitted to us, we are immediately original persons. In other words, practice allows us to live as an original person in this moment, rather than become an original person sometime in the future. Dogen compares the self to a boat sailing on the ocean with the coast in view. He says that just as it's a mistake to think the coast is moving rather than the boat, it's also a mistake to think of the self as a fixed, unchanging object, subject, around which shifting objects revolve. So he's now comparing the self to a person riding on the ocean in a boat, and it's a circle. And here he says, Dogen is discussing the matter of living as an original person based on the clear insight that all things are empty, lacking independent existence. That you can't find anything that is not attached to everything else. Impossible. He talks about Dogen's trip to China, and then goes on to talk about seeing the single circle as enlightenment. After sailing out to the vast ocean, one can only see the ocean, its circular horizon, and the vast sky. Only the oneness, or not two-ness, of all things can be seen. Looks like everything's been erased. This is a surprising experience, but is it enlightenment? Is it the goal of practice? Dogen answers this question with resounding no. He says that the Dharma has not yet fully penetrated into body and mind. When we think of seeing the unity of things is enlightenment. True realization, Dogen wrote, goes beyond seeing the unity of things. When the Dharma fills body and mind, one thinks something is still lacking, means that when truly filled by Dharma, we see the incompleteness of our practice and perceive the characteristics of all things are so subtle and complex and innumerable that we understand we must keep looking and asking endlessly into the nature of all things. And as bodhisattvas, we must perpetually explore the proper way to sincerely practice with all beings. We also realize that as individuals, what we can see is limited. No matter how deep, how high, or how broadly we focus our vision, our view will always be limited. To see this limit is wisdom. That's disappointing. It can be disappointing. We'd like to think we could somehow pull ourselves up, lift ourselves into a realm in which we would not be confused and stupid about anything. And it just doesn't happen. That isn't what life is. Life has a different kind of magic from that. That's a very simple-minded kind of magic. That's really a foolish kind of dream. He says, because we must take a position in reality, we can't see the parts of it that are hidden by our own existence. The range of our eyesight is less than 180 degrees. When we're looking ahead, we can't see behind, vice versa. We're very, very limited, actually. We're very clumsy, two-legged, not really designed to even be upright like this. Yet we do have the ability to remember things we've seen before and integrate them with what we're seeing now, and so we can create a picture, a mental picture, representing the visual range of everything that's around us, more or less. In the same way, we're capable of creating a mental image of what we think is total reality. We must understand that these are just images, mental representations of the world. It's just ideas that we're thinking. The world is right here, this. Even the circular horizon of the ocean is a mental construct and a limited view of the conditioned self. When we see that our views of oneness, as well as our discriminating views, are simply mental constructs, we begin to see true reality. seeing that we're deluded is the wisdom of seeing the true reality of our lives. And then he quotes Kodo Sawaki, who always has great examples. He says, everyone reads the sections of the newspaper in a different order. One person reads the stock market page first. Another turns first to the sports page, a novel, political columns. We're all different because we see things through our own individual discriminating consciousness. Grasping things with human thought, we each behave differently. We can't know the actual world, the world common to everyone, until we stop discriminating. In other words, read the whole paper, not just the sports section. Because we each have different karma, says Okamura, each of us sees the world differently. And yet then we begin to develop opinions. And that creates some problems until we, as he says, open the hand of thought and understand that whatever our opinion about things is, it's an opinion. It's one more thought. It's a product of our conditioning, of the situation, of who we are at the moment, what we had for breakfast, what our grandmother said to us 20 years ago, etc., etc. We cannot even begin to measure and identify what makes every second of our life. Kodo Sawaki also said, people often say, in my opinion, anyhow, my opinion is no good, so keep your mouth shut. So Okamura says to stop discriminating occurs only when we let go of thought in the sitting practice of Zazen. It's why we sit. We see that we're just thinking. We can't so easily create a story without seeing that it's a story. Oh, I'm just sitting here looking at a wall, and I've gone through all these amazing stories and dramas in my life, and I've talked to so many people, and I've gone to so many places. It's astonishing. And yet, if we realize that we're constantly doing that, that realization is wisdom. Oh, this is what human being does. This is what we're wired to do. Squirting out thoughts. Blah, 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 blah. The next section is called A Palace for Fish, Water, and Water for Human Beings. So the different beings seeing the water in different ways. And then he goes to the Mountains and Water Sutra, which is very much like this sutra. It's beautiful poetry also. And it's about nature also, and it has the same message. And so he quotes a good deal of it. So it's all questioning fixed, independent existence. Even the water. Different kinds of beings see it as different things. So each type of being sees the one true reality of water according to one of four different incomplete views, according to some. Dogen says that we cannot be certain that there is a real true reality of water. How could we possibly know? At least one that exists outside of the relationship between beings that are viewing and the water that's being viewed. So we can, when I was a child, my mother decided she wanted to be an artist, and she thought we should all do that. So she got little boxes of paints for us, and I guess it was canvas, or maybe it was a copy of a canvas, and took us out to paint things. And there were five of us. I had two younger brothers, and my father was an engineer. So if we were painting a bridge, mother, who was a writer, would paint a very poetic, beautiful bridge. And my father would be measuring things with his being absolutely accurate and sure. And the two boys were silly, and so they did silly bridges. And you look at it and you think, we're just looking at one bridge, right? Just that one bridge. And all five of us had different versions of it. And that's just a little bitty example of how it is for all of us all the time, really. It's kind of interesting. He brings up Yogacara, which says that everything is mind, the mind only. Each being sees its own version of water according to its own conditioned consciousness. For Yogacara teachers, nothing exists outside consciousness. Dogen, however, uses the same analogy to say that the self and the world are working together within a relationship of interdependent origination. The world and all its contents appear within this relationship between the self and the myriad dharmas. In a sense, the relationship between beings and water creates the beings' views of water. The important point for Dogen is how one acts or practices in this relationship with the myriad dharmas. His concern is not with the existence or non-existence of the self and the myriad dharmas. In fact, he questions all philosophical views we might hold concerning our relationship to the myriad dharmas and deconstructs any concepts we might cling to. So it's all about what is happening between the between in every moment. It isn't that there's no world and no self. In a sense, there is all of it, all together, all the time. So he goes on in that fascicle to say, all the myriad things are like this. Within the dusty world and beyond, there are innumerable aspects and characteristics we only see or grasp as far as the power of our eye of study and practice can see. When we listen to the reality of myriad things, we must know that there are inexhaustible characteristics in both ocean and mountains, and there are many other worlds in the four directions. This is true not only in the external world, but right under our feet or within a drop of water. So he's saying the world, the dusty world, is the secular world, and the world beyond is the world of Dharma with a big D. Beyond the standards of the ordinary world. Nagarjuna calls them conventional truth and ultimate truth, or two truths. But what Dogen says, although we're not individual, independent, fixed entities, we still have to experience. That's sort of leaping ahead, but experience pain. So pain is real. So fresh, so immediate. Now it has to be taken care of. All pain originates from emptiness, but each individual pain has its particular causes and conditions. So we must find the cause of each particular pain and decide how to take care of it. Simply seeing the emptiness or oneness of all things, of all beings, does not relieve pain. Simply seeing the emptiness or oneness of all beings does not relieve pain. So that's a place to get caught too. That too is an idea. There's time for discussion, and I think I will stop here, even though I'm not quite finished, so that we can finish up next week and talk a little bit, because it's a lot. It's a lot. Somebody has something to add or subtract?
Did I ask you to read the part about giving up discernment again?
Giving up
discernment.
Discernment. It's discrimination.
Discrimination.
To give up discriminating. Any view is the product of a particular set of conditions, circumstances, and experiences. We must give up seeing our own views as absolutely true. Non-discrimination is represented as a circle. To stop discriminating occurs only when we let go of thought in the sitting practice of Zazen. It's about not fully penetrating body and mind. Yeah. True realization goes beyond seeing the unity of things. When the Dharma fills body and mind, one thinks something is still lacking. Means that when truly filled by Dharma, we see the incompleteness of our practice and perceive that the characteristics of all things are subtle, complex, and innumerable. We then understand that we must inquire endlessly into the nature of all things. And as bodhisattvas, we must perpetually explore the proper way to practice with all things. We see that the, let's see, we also realize that as individuals, what we can see is limited. No matter how deep, how high, or how broadly we focus our vision, our view will always be limited. To see this limit is wisdom. Done. And it's always interesting. Never stops being interesting.
That the end product that you're trying to get at is understanding, like the nature, mm-hmm. as opposed to experiencing the nature. So that it's more, you know, it's just more thought.
Well, it can be, can't it? Yes. But it can also give you a sense of the incredible complexity of things and a deeper and deeper respect for life. It's about trying to understand, really, not in order to manipulate life, but to actually meet it. It's about allowing oneself to meet it, rather than overlooking most of it, which is what we usually do. I don't think it means filling a lot of books with information. I don't think that's what he means. I think he means to study how it works. It's very much about acting, action. So you begin to see how life is enacting itself in relationship everywhere.
I guess the problem I'm having is that maybe you can't do that without also working on yourself, because you're always projecting out into the world. So that's where I'm kind of stuck, is that if you do it without saying that what I'm understanding is tentative and could change and I'm not seeing the whole picture, then
that's called a healthy scientific mind. Isn't it? Yeah. It's a wonderful mind. Always thinking, I'm not sure. You know, this is what I think right now, but we have to find out more. We always have to find out more. And the foundation of our knowledge is greater. It's both. One part of it's the dusty world, and the other part is the other world. The Zazen world, you could say. Yeah, it's a good question. Good question. Well, it's 8 o'clock. We need somebody who is willing to see that the place gets opened up on Tuesday nights and the Saturdays that we're meeting, who keeps track of those who are willing to open it up, so that there's always somebody. Leslie did it at the drop of a hat this time with Wendy
and Judy.
But we never know, and I think it would be a lot easier, especially on Wendy, who has been organizing it up to now, and she's the treasurer of the board, and that means she has to do all the taxes and the insurance and keep track of all the Quaker stuff, so she doesn't need to be doing the opening of the Zendo. Could you be in charge of that?
Yes.
Violet, you're a heroine. Thank you. Great.
And it would also entail a Doan and Makupio sign rules.
You can take a Wendy lesson. Well, you can arrange things when you're not here.
Exactly.
Yeah. Excellent. That's very good.
Thank you, Violet. I know you also manage the audio on the website.
Is there anything else?
I thought that since we have so many people here, I channeled my form of being a bit, you know. So just to clarify, in the service, I think people get confused about your first bow at the altar. So you can't see them because your back is up. So.
Okay.
So when Angie, after we do the three bows, she does a bow inside this kind of the circle of the altar, her personal bow. And we don't bow. And then she does that little step back, and that's when we bow.
Yeah.
So we just let her have her little private bow, and then when she does the step back, we don't bow with her, and then wait till she gets to her seat and bow again, and then she turns and we bow again.
Thank you, Marie.
Yeah. I listened to the audio of when you actually set up the service. I found it in the archives.
Ah.
And so that was pretty fascinating.
Oh, yes, I bet.
The way you just described it was beautiful, clear. I like the idea that there's a little space just for Angie.
Just through the altar, she bows at the altar.
In fact, you're supposed to be walking around and around it and serving incense at the altar and then walking back and then coming over and incense again. It's a wonderful little dance that the priest does, but we don't do that. So. Yeah.
And if I could add, basically, you just bow when the bell rings.
Yes.
So Angie will have her little bow without a bell. So then you wouldn't bow.
That's
because there's no bell.
That's right. Thank you. That makes it very simple. Yes. Okay. Wendy?
Another service detail is that we bow to the altar, and then we face each other to bring the chant.
Mm-hmm. And listen to each other.
Okay.
That's the best of it. When you're listening to the whole thing, then your own voice becomes a part of it in a way that's different from just trying to keep up. It's the music we're making. And it's a communal music, so listen.
So Angie's going to be here tomorrow night with the Insight, San Jose Insight group at 7:30 this time.
Right.
And then next Tuesday,
John
will be here, so. And And if you aren't getting emails from me, I'll send out a calendar for August. Maybe you're not on our list, so give me your email and I'll make sure you get on our list.
Okay, thank you everyone. 1 minute sit.